I actually had extensive contact with someone who claims to have worked on the Montauk project. Now, this is not Swerdlow or Bielik or Preston Nichols or anybody who's come forward. This guy chooses to go by the pseudonym Daniel, and he has not come forward except to me. And
how did you find him, if you can tell us?
Well, short, quick version, because we don't have a lot of time, is that I got stranded in Albany visiting my mother one winter at the Albany airport.
That happens in Albany.
And I had to take a little shuttle bus to a hotel, and I was hungry. I was planning on eating when I got to her house, and I ended up going to a Denny's. And I had brought this Montauk Project book with me basically almost as a joke, because I'd bought it years ago and thought that it was all completely, you know, ridiculous. And I'm reading it in the Denny's, and this guy walks by who actually looked like a biker. I mean, he had a big burly beard, and he had a leather jacket on, and, dingy denim pants. And this dude says, so are you're interested in that, huh? I said, well, not really. He said, well, I worked at Montauk. And I just laughed. And
to yourself?
Well, no. To him.
I mean, really? All right.
I was trained in martial arts. So
take it. Okay. All right.
But, you know, I mean, I laughed. And I just, it was just a very natural, spontaneous reaction. And he kept on going with it. And I just started to ask him questions. And the next thing I knew, after, you know, about 20 minutes of interrogation, I realized, you know, something really happened to this guy. He's not lying. And I've since been able to have multiple long interactions with him. And he described that there was a seat that came out of one of these ships. And to make a long, long story short, they hooked it up to a very, very high-intensity power supply and found that if you did something called zeroing out the chair, which meant there were like 22, something like that, wavelengths coming from somebody's mind when they're meditating, you try to get to a place they call quiet point where you have no mental activity. And then they would flatten out all these sine wave graphs that would be the description of your mind. And once they flatten them out and they zero out the chair, as it's called, then whatever you think would manifest in the room, supposedly. Now, this includes like materialization of objects as physical things. It also included, you know, scary mind control stuff. But more importantly, when you thought about a particular place, portals would appear in the room that you could actually send people through. In many cases, they didn't make it, but in a lot of cases, they would, and you could go to another place. It was only later in the project that they discovered that, you know, that they were actually able to go through time as well as space. And this sounds completely outlandish. However, what we're coming to understand is that this parallel reality I was speaking of before the break is a domain where space and time are completely inverted. In other words, here we have what appears to be, according to Einstein, one dimension of time, which basically just moves forward like a river, and we have three dimensions of space. Well, that one dimension of time is the only one we can see, but time is actually three-dimensional, and there's a system of physics from Dewey-Larson called reciprocal system, where if you actually attack time as being three-dimensional, which gets into Richard's hyperdimensional physics,
right,
then you can solve all the problems of quantum physics very easily. But the deal is this. If you transition yourself over to time-space and you walk 10 feet in time-space and then you re-enter here without going back to the point that you started from, so like if you walk 10 feet and then you don't go back to where you started, you will have traveled in time when you come back over to this side of the fence. Now, that's why in the ancient legends of the fairy circles, they say it's very important if you enter a fairy ring in which, you know, when you go through on the other side, you see these little people like gnomes and fairies and dwarves and so forth, that you have to go back into the fairy circle the way you went in the first time, or else you will actually travel in time. That's in a lot of these old medieval grimoires. So it appears, from what he was telling me, that when you basically hyper-accelerate somebody's vibration to this higher dimension, that they can move over there, and what is a physical movement in space over there is a movement in time over here, so that when you crank yourself back down into our time, into our side of the fence of these two domains, you know, space-time and time-space, When you come back, you've actually traveled in time. Now, apparently, they found a 20-year wave, a sine wave, that came out from the printouts of the chair, because the chair had hundreds and hundreds of different graphs that could be printed out. And this 20-year wave apparently is related to the harmonics of the Earth's vibration. And they were able to precisely calculate where in time somebody was by how far along this sine wave went.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And this is not stuff I've ever heard from any other Montauk witnesses. What they found was that on exactly December 21st, 2012, all of the hundreds of wavelengths that the chair would crank out went flatline for like 5 or 6 seconds. Now, all these dudes that were at the top levels of this program, they were salivating to try to get that data, because during that exact moment that people were traveling through what looked like basically a wormhole, like you see in Contact at the end of the movie,
mm-hmm.
or in Stargate SG-1, for example, during that time, it's like you get thumped really, really hard by an energy, like you hit a wall of energy, basically. And they call it the bump. And they also called it the full out. And when you hit this wall, you experience cosmic consciousness. You feel as if you know everything. You're complete ecstasy, spiritual ecstasy. You could be like the size of the galaxy, the size of an atom. Everything you'd ever want to know is there. It's complete euphoria. You have no sense of time passing. And then also, Daniel's research concluded that anything that you see after 2012 is completely based on the prejudices of the person running the chair and the prejudices of the person who is seeing the experience.
Really?
In other words, it seems to be a wrinkle in time where you have to pass through this point where all the graphs would go flatline, and then, you know, they could never get that data, but that's what they wanted, because they wanted to play it back through the chair without somebody in it and then try to go through it themselves if they could get it to a point where it was systematic. See, a lot of these guys didn't want to go through the chair themselves because they didn't want to lose their lives, but they were really, you know, seriously wanting to know what was happening when people hit this bump in 2012. And that's also ties in with Burrish's material, where it appears on his, from his information, that there's this surge of energy from the center of the galaxy and from the sun that bombards us with what Burrish calls micro wormholes, which actually have a stimulating effect on DNA. And I have a whole huge amount of science on that, and we can talk about the product that I have at the end of the show where I talk about that. But importantly here is the idea that it seems as if this 2012 event, all of the black ops stuff that I'm hearing that seems the most credible keeps saying the same thing, which is that the physical vibration of matter as we know it, which is ultimately geometric, and that's another long, we could do a whole show on that with Richard Hoagland and myself, about the geometry of the quantum field, of quantum physics. Geometry can change shape by increasing its frequency. It can change from one form to another. And physical matter can do that. That's why these objects are disappearing, like in the Philadelphia experiment with the arc welding, as I said, with the monatomic iridium when you raise it above 800 degrees Celsius, with Bermuda Triangle, where you have whole fleets of planes that just disappear with no flotsam, no wreckage, no oil on the surface of the ocean. They just are gone.
Do they ever come back?
Sometimes they do. There was one guy who went through the Bermuda Triangle and said that he went into a green mist and lost all of his navigational instruments and felt very strange. In his case, he actually managed to come out alive. There are other people who have seen strange vortexes of clouds that they flew through. And there's actually a case of a Korean Airlines jet, a 747, that was lost radar contact for 10 minutes. And they're sitting there in the cockpit of the plane listening to the control tower, and they had no perception that time had elapsed. 1 minute, they're talking to the control tower, everything's fine, then all of a sudden everybody in the control tower is screaming, "What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? Are you okay? Are you okay?" Well, they said, "What are you talking about? We were just talking to you a minute ago." And they said, "No, you've been dead air for 10 minutes. Well, then when everybody landed, every single clock and timepiece on the entire plane was 10 minutes off. So they just stepped
That's
out of
weird.
Time as we know it for 10 minutes. And when they came back, their clocks had not advanced, but our time had. So this is one of the really strange new physics things that we've had to learn, is that time is locally variable. You can have these Russian devices called torsion field generators in which you can actually change the flow of time to the point that you can take an ordinary watch or timepiece and have its measurement of time change when you zap it with this field.